So we've just done a period of meditation. We've done it in the way that I teach when I teach mindfulness courses. It's only slightly different from what we do in Buddhist centers, usually. So what do we do when we meditate? What's happening? And in a sense, that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight. The title of my talk is Mindfulness and Liberation. And meditation is going to be a key theme, because meditation is connected both with mindfulness and also where mindfulness can take us. But I want to start approaching it a bit more obliquely. What is it we're doing when we meditate? And the thought that sometimes when we meditate, we feel something greater than what's happening in the moment. And I sometimes have the image of our ancestors and our ancestors' ancestors on the plains, on the savannah, waiting, watching for whatever prey they are hoping to catch. Or perhaps examining the roots and the berries for what they can eat. We needed, in the hundreds of thousands of years of prehistory, we needed attention, alertness, presence in order to survive. And I saw the fascinating film by Werner Herzog, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which is about the cave paintings in a cave called Chauvet Caverne in France. The oldest of them are 32,000 years old. And Werner Herzog says that the silence is so complete that you can hear your heartbeat. So silence is not a new thing in human history. It's one of the oldest things. And stillness is not one of is not a new thing in our history, even though mindfulness is in the headlines. It's one of the oldest things. And these are important parts of mindfulness. There's also the wisdom, the skill of the craftsman, the fletcher who straightens arrows, the carpenter, the animal tamer. And when we read the early accounts of the Buddha's life, he evokes these, he draws on them. In my mind, he's fascinated by the example of those people. He says, irrigators draw off waters, fletchers straighten arrows, carpenters shape wood. The man of understanding makes straight the trembling, unsteady mind, which is difficult to guard and difficult to restrain. And I like to imagine the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, growing up in what would, by our standards, be not much more than a village. And a pre-modern village where you see these craftsmen. I imagine him as a boy fascinated by the skill of a fletcher who has to carve a perfectly straight arrow that can fly exactly where it's directed, by a carpenter planing and sawing, by an irrigator who needs to understand how water flows and how to get it from the spring to his crops without losing it along the way. And seeing in that intent concentration an image of what he came to understand, he needed to do with his own mind. He needed to learn to shape it, to work with it. And he needed the same kind of skill. But the material of meditation isn't wood, it isn't earth, it isn't like training an animal even. The material is the mind. And in the text, which the earlier quote I gave comes from, the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, the mind is extremely subtle, difficult to grasp. And we know that, we discover that, the moment we sit down to meditate. He also says the mind is frivolous and difficult to control, alighting on whatever it pleases. And who can sit for any length of time without knowing the truth of that? Frivolous, difficult to control, alighting on whatever it pleases. Something pleases the mind, it wants to go there, it wants to stay there, and it wants to keep thinking about it. Just watch our thoughts. Watch the anxious thoughts about what might happen, the regrets about what's gone by. We see this in the moment. So meditation is about being still, it's about being present, but it's not exactly the hunter's stillness, which is concerned with warding off threats, the threats of hunger, of starvation, of wild animals, and of achievement, of catching the prey. It's not about threat, and it's not about achievement. It's not about the emotions that grow out of those, of aversion or craving. It's about something else. Mindfulness and meditation are natural, I believe, but they're also deliberate. And meditation is a skill of considerable subtlety. When we turn towards the mind, turn towards our experience with mindfulness, with meditation, we're guiding or cultivating it. And there are really two aspects to this. And they're the two aspects that we encounter the very first time we meditate. And actually, they're the two aspects that will be with us all the way through a journey into meditation. And the first aspect is stillness, learning to still the mind. The second is the process of investigation and reflection on whatever we discover. And then letting that change us. So stilling, reflecting. And those of you who know Buddhist teachings, I come on to this, will know that I'm talking about the two categories of meditation, samatha and vipassana. So, where does it all come from? Let me take a step back. Mindfulness. It's, we're in a mindful moment in our culture. Mindfulness is in the news. People come on my courses and I ask them, where did you hear about mindfulness? And they say, I heard it on something on the radio, I read something in the Daily Mail, I saw something in on the television, I read Ruby Wax's book, it's everywhere. Kamala Gita, who's my wife, her mother gave her a copy of Woman and Home, and there is a great big double spread on mindfulness and sex. Now, you can't get much more mainstream than that. So, why? I think the answer, actually, is something to do with our culture and what's needed in our culture. Mindfulness is exactly the opposite of the things that are becoming stronger and stronger in our culture. The stimulation that we have everywhere we look, and also the mental distress, which is becoming more and more prevalent and more of a problem. The World Health Organization says that by 2020, depression will be the biggest problem worldwide. The NHS prescribed 46 million antidepressants in 2011, and that was a 500% increase on the figures a decade before. According to some statistics, a third of people, of young people between 15 and 25, suffer some degree of psychiatric problems, mild or severe. That isn't an epidemic. I'd like to know what the definition of an epidemic really is. So there are all of these reasons why mindfulness has become something that's in the news and in our minds. What I want to do in this talk is to put the mindfulness that's out there into a context, the context of where it originates, which also has something to say about what that mindfulness practice really means, where it takes us, what it signifies, and what it can mean in our lives. The agenda is not that if you want to practice mindfulness, you have to be a Buddhist, or even that mindfulness is really a Buddhist thing, and Buddhists somehow own it. No one owns mindfulness. Mindfulness is an aspect of the mind, and no one owns the mind. You can't own mindfulness any more than you can own compassion or memory. Mindfulness is one of the things that the mind does. But having said that, it's what the mind does in a very, it's the way we use the mind in a very particular way. And that process is what's been understood within the Buddhist tradition, and it's that understanding that's making it of particular relevance now. So where do we start? Let's go back to the forest. Let's go back to a man sitting in a glade of the forest, not about to spear an animal, not looking for roots or berries, just sitting. And imagine the extent of the forest, the depth of the trees, the density of the canopy, the birds flashing through the sky, the deep forest, and a glade within that forest. And a man sitting still, alert, erect, quiet. His eyes not gazing around for threats, even though presumably in the jungle, which is really what we're talking about, there are threats. His eyes are closed. He's looking within. So this man we know as Gotama, and the time when we're picturing him is 2,500 years ago, roughly, in northwestern India, northeastern India, in fact. And well, he's, let's say, in his early 30s. Not yet the person who's known as the Buddha, but the person who's on his way to becoming the Buddha. He wears a yellow robe. In fact, a kind of dark mud yellow ochre robe, dyed in the mud of the river. And it's sewn together from scraps. He doesn't own anything, particularly perhaps a bowl where people can put his food. He's gaunt. In fact, he's not far off skeletal, because what he's been doing for much of his time until now is practicing in the ancient Indian tradition of austerities, self-mortification, where you starve yourself, you punish your body, in order to release it from the prison of flesh and physicality. That's what they told him to do, so he did it. Before that, people had been told him to do something else, something to do with experiencing mystical states of mind, which were probably all wrapped up with various beliefs about God and the soul and so on and so forth. So he's followed all of these traditions, and he's come through his austerities to the point of death. And at the point of death, a memory comes up. A memory of sitting quietly beneath a rose apple tree, and joy and happiness spreading through him in a natural state of expansiveness, openness, and absorption. And that is in such utter contrast with the harried state he's in at the present moment, that it speaks to him. It speaks through the darkness and his pain, and it shows him that there's an alternative way of practicing, which isn't about treating the body or the mind as an enemy, but treating them as allies. At least certain aspects of the mind, capacities and qualities within the mind that we all have. Those moments of spontaneous happiness and understanding that we all have. And it's in those moments that we find the clues to what will really help us move forward. The moments when we feel most fully ourselves. And that's what Gotama realized. And those moments were nothing to do with beliefs. Nothing to do with theories or assumptions or ideas about God or about anything like that. They were to do with himself, his mind, and not just his mind in its distracted state, but its mind at its best. If he could trust his mind, trust its capacity to expand into that space, then he could find a way forward. So that's what he does. That part of the story is well known, but I want to particularly focus on the next part of the story. What he does after he's adopted this approach to meditation. What he does is to start to notice his experience. He turns towards the mind without any assumptions about what it looks like, without any ideas about what his experience really means. He just looks towards it. What does he notice? Well, we turn to the early Buddhist sources. We find that he talks about noticing that the things he's done in the past are still somehow present in his experience. They've made an impression on the mind. It's the first thing he notices. Second thing he notices in the discourses is that there are different kinds of mental streams in his mind. So he realizes, although it's complicated, he can actually simplify things by dividing them into two categories, two kinds of thought. So one kind of thought is produced by ill will, craving, ill will, and cruelty. Okay? Craving, ill will, and cruelty. And he notices that when he dwells on those thoughts, he dwells in those states of mind, he gives them his attention, they grow. They bring him suffering. And then, and he reflects back, he sees that they actually led to other people's suffering. His state of mind has led to other people's suffering. And then he notices other states of mind, and he cites renunciation, friendliness, and compassion. And these states of mind lead to his happiness. If he dwells on them, then they grow. So that might seem a fairly simple, obvious kind of thing to notice. If you are in a bad mood and you just stay in a bad mood, then it doesn't stop. It gets worse, probably. Especially if you feed it and dwell on it. We all kind of know that. But the Buddha, and this is one of the reasons I think the Buddha is so important. The Buddha is a particular kind of thinker, particular kind of person, has the capacity not just to notice with great precision, but also to generalize from his experience. So he sees two things, really. Firstly, that the mind itself is his main concern. The mind is what human beings ought to be concerned about above all. And I'm just going to say a little bit more about that, because it's, again, that's one of the such an obvious point, really. We have minds, and they work in a certain sort of way. But when I teach my courses, I often feel that that is the great lesson that people learn. We know, and maybe people of a few generations hadn't quite thought about this in the same way, we know that our bodies are important. If we're feeling fit and well, we feel one way, and our body will feel one way, and if it's ill or out of shape or something like that, it'll feel another way. And yet we don't really reflect that way on the mind. So this is the second great insight, that our experience, our minds, are conditioned. Or he came to put it more precisely, Well, it actually, the first way he put it was to say that what we dwell upon and what we ponder and frequently dwell upon becomes the inclination of our thoughts. So if you think about making money all the time, you put a lot of energy into that, then you will keep on thinking about making money. And if the state of mind that goes with that is one, presumably, of craving, then the craving will grow. He then, later on, he put it in a slightly different way. He said, things arise, our experience arises in dependence upon the conditions that we establish. External conditions, internal conditions. And then in the Dhammapada again, he says, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. And if one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never parts. Our actions have consequences. Not just our external actions, but our mental actions. How we think, how we pay attention, what we do with our thoughts. The cause of our mental state lies in how we use our minds. We can shape our minds, and what follows from that is that we can shape our minds. We can remake our experience. And this is the principle that underlies the whole of the Buddhist path. That capacity that human beings have to reshape the consciousness. And my own personal, I don't know if it's a theory or it's certainly my belief, is I think the Buddha discovered that in a way that no one had before, and in fact remains quite distinctive. A certain way of looking at the mind, first of all its importance, and secondly, the fact that it's fluid and it's shaped and it's conditioned and we can engage with the conditions. That is the Buddha's genius. How do we do it? That's the next question. How do we shape the mind? And then we come to the two categories I mentioned earlier. First of all, stilling the mind, and secondly, reflecting. So, we still the mind. That's what we experience when we meditate. We notice, first of all, the mind's turbulence. We know that's the very first thing, the never-resting mind. It just keeps going. Our thoughts go in every direction, can sometimes seem. How are we going to shift that if we don't find it satisfactory? And here there's a paradox, because the only material we have to change this restless, frivolous, scattered, dispersed mind is the mind. So how on earth can we do it? How can the mind change itself? So, just talk through a few of the kind of basic elements that we actually experience. It's true that the mind is often very scattered and rather turbulent. But it's also true that there are many different aspects to our experience. And this, again, I think we owe a great deal to the Buddha for identifying, in the midst of this mixed mental landscape, certain elements that are particularly helpful. Mindfulness is one of them, and that's one of the things I want to talk about. Mindfulness is our capacity to notice. We can notice our bodies. We notice our physical experience. We can notice through the body, we notice our surroundings. We can notice our thoughts. And this, again, is something that is sometimes a revelation for people when we teach mindfulness courses, that we don't just have thoughts, get carried away by them. We can stand back from them and notice that we're having thoughts. And when we notice, we can start to ask questions about them, like, are they true? For certain people, that is a revelation. And in fact, it's a liberating realization. We can notice our feelings as well. And again, when we notice our feelings with mindfulness, it means we're not immersed in them. So mindfulness is the capacity to stand back from and observe, but not in a cold way, in a curious way, in an interested, engaged, and perhaps kindly way. So noticing thoughts then allows us to let them go. That's what we practice again and again in meditation. Notice a thought, let it go. And when we let it go, we change our relationship with it. We're no longer identified with it, we're standing back from it. And there are many names for this process. When we notice angry, rancorous thoughts, the name for that, when we let it, the name for letting it go, I think, is forgiveness. When we notice anxious thoughts and we let them go, the name for that is contentment. When we notice restless thoughts, not quite sure what the name is, maybe grounding. When you notice restlessness and you let it go, settling, grounding, that sort of thing. And so in that way, simply by noticing, simply by learning that process of letting go, we already start to engage in a process of what in Buddhism we call mental cultivation, which is, you know, really what the whole process of meditation is about. But it's not just about the mind in isolation. When we distinguish between the mental states of cruelty and loving kindness, for example, we bring in an ethical dimension. We bring in the distinction between different kinds of actions, and we don't want in Buddhism to call them good or bad because that's an idea about them. That involves having a category of goodness, a category of badness. That can't come out of observation. So the Buddha, rather brilliantly, used the terms skillful and unskillful, going back to those craftsmen. The skilled ones don't botch their carpentry. Their arrows fly straight. Their ditches carry the water to the crops. And the skilled meditator, the skilled mental cultivator, will act ethically. They'll cultivate states of mind of compassion and forgiveness and so on. And they will cultivate a happier, more capable, more effective mind. So ethics and the mind, from this perspective, are intimately connected, because with those states of mind, we'll act in certain ways. So, stilling the mind and letting go. Letting go of the things that are skillful, relatively or absolutely. So, with the mindfulness approach to meditation, what we tend to do is to allow the mind to become still and then use that awareness to notice the different elements, our thoughts, our feelings, and we investigate them. That's one choice that we can make in meditation. There's another choice which extends that process of letting go in a slightly different direction. And that's the process of becoming increasingly absorbed and deeper levels. Still about letting go, actually. So that's one way of talking about it. When we let go of things like restlessness and anxiety and ill will and craving, then the mind becomes still. Becomes very still and very happy and joyful. And this is a state of mind, when the mind settles like a clear pool of water, a state of mind which is called absorption, or in the ancient Buddhist languages, jhana or dhyana. And that's wonderful. You read poetry and people are describing this all the time. But It goes further. In that state of mind, we're still thinking, or at least we have the capacity to think. And the Buddha describes, in fact, meditators frequently experience states of mind where not only do we stop thinking, but the very elements of our mind that are to enable us to think conceptually, we let go of them as well. That's the second absorption. At that point, the body is full of blissful energy, welling up like a fountain or like an underground spring. And even that can be let go of, because there's something a little crude about this energy welling up. So we let go of that, we enter the third absorption, which is a state of clear mental happiness, mindfulness and equanimity. And even that mental happiness, even that sense of pleasure, of I'm enjoying this, is something we can abandon, can let go of, and enter into an even deeper state of mind, which we call the fourth absorption. And I'm going to stop there. There are actually another five to go, but that'll do for now. The point is really that meditation is quite an open-ended process, because if the mind is conditioned, if what we do with the mind is can reshape it almost entirely, then there's actually no limit to the depth of experience we can we can gain through meditation, the depth of stillness that we can experience, because it's just how we're using our minds, what we're holding on to, and what we have the capacity to let go. Now, every time we let go of a thought, we're engaging in that process. Every time we notice we're thinking about our things to-do list for tomorrow, and we think, oh no, I should be thinking about the breath, come on back to the breath, a small process of transformation occurs. Not only do we change our relationship with our things to-do list, we also, you may have noticed, are left with a feeling. It's the feeling of wanting to think about our things to-do list. It's the feeling of slight restlessness and disappointment. We feel slightly bereft of the stimulation and entertainment that's been gained by dwelling on this things to-do list. And then that feeling is what's keeping us in a certain kind of state of mind. So when we bring awareness to that feeling, what we're doing is we're investigating our experience. And when we can shift that, release it, let it go, understand it more deeply, we become a slightly different person. So now we move on to the second of these great phases of meditation. There's a process of stilling the mind, but even in that process, we're already engaging in another process, which is investigating our experience, reflecting on our experience, and understanding it more deeply. So this is what in Buddhist tradition we call vipassana, but I think it's important to say that it's nothing very high-flown to start with. It's simply learning the lessons of our experience. In fact, it's always just learning the lessons of our experience. We come back to that initial problem that I mentioned. How can we understand ourselves more deeply when all we've got, the only tool we have is our mind, which is full of biases and habits and all the prejudices that we bring with us. We can think about it. Well, maybe, yeah, that's helpful. But thinking only becomes transformative when it connects with our experience. So there's something between thinking about things and just following our experience. And that's having a framework within which to understand our experience. And this is why, within a Buddhist context, we have the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha's ideas about what our experience is. So that is something to test our experience out against. He says, yeah, okay, you're thinking about your things to do list, you're thinking about the conversation you had today, you're thinking about sex, right? I understand that, but there's a character of this experience. And if you want to really get beyond all of that, you're going to need to reflect on your experience in terms of that character. There's three things you need to notice. Firstly, that experience is unsatisfactory. It's not a state of, there's nothing within it that can be finally, ultimately satisfactory and satisfying. There's restlessness, we can't shift. Why? Well, maybe that's something to do with the next thing that's really important to notice. It's impermanent. It's constantly changing. There's nothing that stays the same. And we constantly try to get our lives under control. We try to make ourselves into a certain kind of person. And it's always changing. And that's that leads to the third point. Who is this me anyway? Who is this big, important person you keep on going on about in your head? Who is it? Is it your body? That's changing all the time. Is it your mind? Well, just been talking about that. Who is this person? So the Buddha says, there's no one there. There's no big me beyond all the things I experience. So these are what Buddha called the three marks of conditioned existence. The three marks of existence. Unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and non-self. And this is what reflection's really about. And together with that process of reflection and the process of stilling the mind, a kind of transformation can occur. Now, I wanted to give you all of that theory because it's so important, but I know it's theory. And what does that look like in practice? So I'm going to talk a little bit personally now. This whole subject of mindfulness and my experience in teaching mindfulness. So I've been teaching in Buddhist centres, doing talks like this for many years, 20 years, I guess. Taught meditation classes over that time as well. But in the mindfulness training context, I discovered that I was actually being asked to do something other than teaching. I don't find teaching difficult, having been doing it for many years. But I was being asked to do something, and I was finding I wasn't really doing it. I kept on slipping into teaching, spieling, talking, expounding, leading meditations. It's quite easy once you know how to do it. Because the other element that's there when in the mindfulness training context is about listening, about communicating with about people's experience as it is, not as you think it is. So we inquire into what people's experience is. And I realized that I was doing much too much teaching and not enough inquiring and not enough really being open to other people. So why? Well, for one thing, it showed up a certain kind of habit of communication that I've developed. Being me, I don't think I'm a particularly poor listener or anything like that, but just a sense of being a little bit more interested in what's going on with me than what's going on with you. I mean, you're very interesting. You're lovely, I'm sure. I'm fascinated to hear about you. I'm just a little bit more fascinated to know about me. So, why? Because of a view that I am more interesting than you are. And a view that, I could talk about this in lots of ways, but, a certain idea about who I am in relation to other people. All of those things, I realised I had to drop it and moving forward as a mindfulness trainer, I realized wasn't just going to be a matter of learning some skills, bolting on some new techniques and skills to me unchanged. I had to change. I had to let go of certain ideas about myself, essentially identifying with the things I'm good at, rather than not identifying and being more open. So, very challenging, rather humiliating, and slightly embarrassing to talk about, but also liberating. And I think that sense of humiliation is very valuable for me, and I think for all of us, because that's when we see, you think, oh my God, is that how I've been going on? Yes, that's right. And I think those moments are very valuable. In order to do that, here's another dimension of this whole process of mindfulness and reflection. We need a lot of kindness. We need kindness for ourselves. I need kindness for myself. And then kindness for others, because that's the whole point. When we stop this focus on ourselves, kindness and sense of connection for others is what emerges. A different way of being, where we're not alone, we're more related to others. So, for me, we're really practicing mindfulness and we're really practicing meditation when our practice engages us with the thoughts, the habits, the feelings that keep us as we are. Now, simply letting go of our thoughts and coming back to the breath, we're already starting to change that, as I've said. And sometimes, when we feel more deeply in touch with ourselves, we can sense those habits, sense those mental currents that the Buddha saw beneath the Bodhi tree, when he's sitting in the forest. We can sense how we are telling ourselves a story about our lives, how we're creating ourselves again and again and again. And we can stop doing it. And we can allow space for something else to emerge. And that is how we get from mindfulness to liberation, which is the title of the talk. What then? What's beyond our experience? Maybe that's not a helpful question to ask, because anything we say about what's beyond our experience can only be an idea, a speculation. But we make sense of the world through intuitions, through stories, through images. So what does liberation feel like for you? The Buddha said that his teaching had one taste, the taste of liberation. And it's liberation from the fetters that are there in our minds. That is the hallmark of what the Buddha called his Dharma. So that's what it feels like. What does it look like? Well, within the Buddhist tradition, it looks like a man, this man, Gotama, back in that grove, erect, alert, and now having fully understood the forces within his mind so that he's able to direct them deep within. He sees those traits, those tendencies, he's able to let them go, and the liberating freedom flows through him. And there he sits. As the forest around him becomes still, the trees bend towards him to cover him over, the animals become quiet, and the silence spreads throughout the jungle. That's what it looks like in the Buddhist tradition. But what does it look like to you? And with that, I'll finish.